Thank you. Good. I'll just point that this way. No, I have lunch with the Duke of Edinburgh once every 6 years, so it's not that often. But I did give him a copy of the book because he's very interested in issues relating to science and faith. Shall I just use this one? Does this switch off? You've done it. Okay. Good. Well, Sir David King, who's the government's chief scientist, said that climate change is a bigger threat than terrorism a little while back. And Sir John Houghton, who's used to be head of the Meteorological Office, said that climate change is a weapon of mass destruction. So I'm going to address that issue tonight of climate change as one of the topics that Christians should address. But I do think it's important to say that Christianity isn't just about being green. It's much more than that, and indeed that's not the most important part of it. Because the most important part of Christianity is getting back into a right relationship with God, which means turning around from our self-centered ways to put God's sovereign rights, if you like, as creator, ahead of them. But having said that, the way that we then treat the world, or the way that we treat the environment, which if we believe God has created it, is a reflection of how we honour and worship him. And the way that we consider the consequences of our actions on others, again, that's a deeply Christian issue. It's a reflection of our love for our neighbour, for instance, if what we're doing is affecting somebody else in a bad way. And I hope I'll show you tonight that people are dying from the effects of climate change already. It's estimated as about 150,000 people a year. And they're not us who cause the problem. They're people who can't do anything about it on the other side of the world. I want to show you a picture. Well, I'll just outline what I'm going to do first. I'm going to, first of all, then talk about some of the scientific issues of global climate change for about half the time. Then I'm going to talk about some theological issues to wrap it up, to see how we should treat those scientific issues. But I'm going to start with the science first. And I wanted just to point out this book by E.O. Wilson, which was published earlier this year, I think, or last year, towards the end of last year, which is written by E.O. Wilson, is probably the greatest living biologist in the world today at Harvard, a professor there. And it's called The Creation, and the subtitle, which you might just be able to read, is An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. And it's a letter to a mythical Southern Baptist pastor. Now, he says quite unambiguously that he's a secular humanist. He belongs to the U.S. Humanist Society. But he also says that religion and science are two of the most powerful forces in the world today. So he says if they could be united on the common ground of biological conservation, for instance, the problem would be solved. So what he's saying, it's really addressed to an American audience, but it's true never worldwide. He says there's 30 million of you Christians there, and you claim to believe in a creator God. There's only a few thousand of us in the secular humanist society. But actually, we both care about this world. So shouldn't you do something about it? Shouldn't we do something about it together? So this issue, I think, of global climate change, because it is a global issue, it's actually an unprecedented opportunity to get people together across nations, across cultures, even across religions, for the common good of humankind. So it's almost unique in that sense, because the scale of the problem requires a global response. And I think it's great, and I hope this will come across, that there is a distinctive Christian message of hope in this debate that we can bring into it. So let me just give you some things you may have seen before. 11 of these are just observations. 11 of the past 12 years were the hottest on record ever. 1998 was the warmest year on record globally ever recorded. 2006 was the hottest year on record in central England and the USA. And England's got the longest historic record of temperature in the world, 348 years of continuous measurements. The rate of change of temperature now is unprecedented. I'm a geologist, and there is nothing in the geological record where the temperature has changed so fast, although it has changed quite a lot, as you'll see later on. And the best estimate now is there's been about a 0.7 degree C rise in global temperature during the 20th century. Well, you might think 0.7 of a degree is not really very much. I'd better stand absolutely still, hadn't I? But it is pretty serious when you think that the difference between an ice age and the temperate period that we're in now is about 5 degrees. You know, 0.7 is getting up there. People are predicting from what we're doing now rises, if we don't change our lifestyles at all, just carry on business as usual. There'll be temperature increases of about 5 degrees by the end of this century. So although it sounds small, these are big numbers. And this is a graph which shows that, really. This is the last 1,000 years. And this is temperature up the side, plus or minus 1 degree. Again, quite small. But it toddled along for 1,000 years. And this is what's happening now. It's shooting up. So on that scale, it's pretty clear. But you'll find people that say, well, the climate changes naturally anyway, doesn't it? It goes up and down. And in fact, I've heard it said on that Channel 4 programme, which I could tell you more about later if you want, that the period of biggest, heaviest industrialisation, just post-war, was followed by a temperature drop. So if global warming is due to lots of carbon dioxide coming out from industry and so on, you should expect to see a temperature rise, and you saw a temperature drop, which indeed you did through the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, although it is increasing now. Well, there is an answer to that, which is pretty simple, actually. It's that, indeed, there's a lot of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere, but also there was an awful lot of pollution going into the atmosphere from all this heavy industry. And some of us, just one or two of you, do you remember the smogs that we used to get in London? This particular smog, which was, I have to say, the year I was born, so I don't remember it, I've just read about it, 4,000 people died in the 1950 smog. And people used to die regularly in winter smogs in London. But of course they don't now, because the pollution has been tidied up. This is a Monet picture, and apparently his painting is so precise in his colours, well, you can work out exactly where he was, where his room was that when he painted this from the angles of these things. But also the colours are so precise that you can work out what the pollution was due to, and you can see this is due to pollution from all the coal fires in London at the time. All that's been cleaned up, and in fact that cleaning up happened through the 60s and 70s with Clean Air Acts that were implemented not just in London but most of the industrialised nations in the north at least. And when that was cleaned up, then you saw the underlying increase of temperature come back again, because all that pollution was actually putting lots of particles in the air that reflected the sun's light and so made it cooler. So there are ups and downs. That particular up and down is due to pollution being cleaned up. There are obvious things. Otherwise, this particular glacier in Argentina has been retreating. And some people have been back to the exact same spot. They found some old photos. This was 1928. Taken another photo in the exact same spot just recently. This was taken in 2004. And look at the difference. All of this ice has gone. Or near at home, if you go to Austria, there's a picture from 1875, and here's a more recent picture, and the ice is all gone. So, interestingly, the glaciers are retreating through much of the world, and that's interesting because glaciers have a big delay in doing it. They have such a big mass. It takes quite a while before they respond to climate change. Now, not everywhere is going to get colder or hotter. Not everywhere is going to get hotter from global climate change. Some places will get colder. Some places will have more rainfall, more snowfall, some will have less. So you can't have a completely simplistic argument, but the global average is as I've shown. Well, what causes global warming? This is quite well understood now. In fact, it's been understood since 1827. There was a French scientist called Jean-Baptiste Fourier who first recognised the greenhouse effect. And in fact, in 1896, there was a Swedish scientist who did some calculations of what would happen if you doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And he said, well, the temperature would increase by 5 to 6 degrees. And interestingly, if you do really sophisticated computer programs, run them now, you get the same sort of number. So for over a century, we've known about the greenhouse effect. And in fact, the greenhouse effect is rather a good thing, because if it weren't for the greenhouse effect on this Earth, it would be about 30 degrees centigrade colder. So it'd be minus 18 degrees out there at the moment, all year. That's the average through the year. And life would not be tenable. I mean, everywhere would be frozen. So greenhouse warming is a good thing to some extent. The problem, as I'll show you in a minute, is the rate of change of what we're doing right at the moment. Well, what causes greenhouse gas? Greenhouse warming, the one you hear about is carbon dioxide, which actually is accountable for about 2/3 of the problem. Methane is accountable for about 1/4 of the global warming. although it's much, much less methane is produced, it's a much more potent greenhouse gas. And there are some other gases which also are fairly potent, and water vapour itself, indeed, is a greenhouse gas as well. Now, there's a little interesting side thing about methane. This is a bit delicate when we've just had dinner. But 18% of the greenhouse warming in the world, which is more than the entire transport sector, including buses and trains and cars and aeroplanes and ships, that's all less than 18%. 18% of the greenhouse warming is due to cows releasing methane from both ends. They produce an average of about 500 litres a day. And, you know, that's a really interesting observation because we know that a lot of land is being chopped down, forest is being chopped down to make grazing for beef. And beef takes about 10 times as much protein. For every kilogram of vegetable, of beef protein, you need about 10 kilograms of vegetable protein. And so there's a real issue about eating a lot of meat, actually. And I'm told that one of the first things that happens in somewhere like India, when you get rich, is you buy a big Jaguar or a Mercedes and you eat lots of meat, big steaks, to show your status. And certainly that's made myself and my wife not become vegetarian, but actually to think about eating a little bit more vegetarian food each week because of this issue. Is humanity responsible for global warming? This is a thermal imaging photo of the House of Parliament, and oranges and reds are hot, right? And the blues and violets are cold. And when this photo was taken a couple of years ago, the Times ran a headline which said, "Proof that Houses of Parliament are full of hot air." So, yes, humanity is causing global warming. But here's a slightly more scientific version of that. People have been building climate models over the years. They've got better and better as computers have got better and better. So here's the last 100 years. And what has been done here is several hundred different computer models from groups all over the world using slightly different methods have been run. And this is the bounds of the results in temperature over the last century, the 20th century. So there's some variation, and this variation is due to natural causes such as El Niño, El Niña, volcanoes erupting, that sort of issue. But if you now put on top of that the actual observed temperature variation, which this black line is, you can see it matches quite well until the middle of the century, and then it diverges markedly. Now, if you run those programs again, those computer programs, now putting in all the production of greenhouse gases from fossil fuels, the coal and the oil that's burnt mainly, and some gas, then the models look like this pink, and they match within those limits of uncertainty quite well. So that's just one indication that humanity is responsible for global warming at the moment. And the issue, as I said earlier, is this rate of change here, which is so fast. Now, here's another example, which is closer to my heart because it's a geological timescale. This is the past 160,000 years now, and this is temperature difference. Now, it might be a bit, if you're near the back, you won't see the scale, but this is naught and this is minus 10 degrees. So between an ice age and a temperate period like now, the temperature changes by up to 10 degrees, and the Earth has done that, so there's no problem in it doing it. And this timescale is about 110,000 years. Now, we have a pretty good idea what's causing this. It's variations in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. They're called Milankovitch cycles. So sometimes we're further away, sometimes we're nearer, and so the temperature changes systematically. And this causes ice ages. But if you now plot carbon dioxide on top of it, the striking thing is that these are coupled so closely. So the world gets hotter, there's more carbon dioxide. The world gets colder, there's less carbon dioxide. They're very closely coupled, and you know, you don't need to be a mathematician to see there's a correlation between the blue and the red curves there. But now look what's happening in the past 50 years to carbon dioxide. It's doing that. It's going up and up. At the moment, it's about 386, I think it is at the moment, parts per million. It's gone up from about 287 or so pre-industrial revolution. So it's getting on for doubling. If we don't do anything about our lifestyles, we just carry on at the moment, then it's going to go way up here. Now, the scary thing about this is that we're just going outside the range that the Earth has experienced, not only for the past 160,000 years here, but for the past million years at least, because we know what it's done by looking at ice cores through through ice caps like those in Greenland. We can go back to 650,000 years. And we're going outside the range the Earth has experienced because we're burning so much fossil fuel, and we're just releasing carbon that took a long, long time to accumulate, millions of years to accumulate underground, and we're releasing it very, very quickly into the atmosphere. And that's much quicker than the Earth can reabsorb it into the oceans or the soils or organisms. It will reabsorb it eventually, but it's a timescale of about 100 years to do that. And it's hotter than it's ever been before already. So it's not just that we're in an ice age and we're making it a bit warmer. We're just going outside the normal range. Now, there isn't a problem with the Earth doing that. It will respond to that, and eventually it will absorb it and the temperature will stabilise again. The real issue is that can humans respond to these changes sufficiently quickly? And I think the answer is no, because humans are tied to land and we fight wars over boundaries, don't we? Maybe we don't, but people do. And if you're tied to a piece of land and it becomes untenable because there's droughts that last 3 years, then you'll either starve or else you'll have to move out into somebody else's land. Now, that's not so easy to do in our world today. So that's the big issue. It's the rate of change, the fact we're going outside the parameters the Earth has experienced before, and we're doing it at a rate of change that is unprecedented. The other issue that I really ought to mention, because it does bear on this problem, is the rate at which population is growing. If you plot population growth since the time when people first had settled settlements and agriculture and so on, Neolithic times, about 10,000 BC, it didn't change much for quite a few thousand years, and now it's shooting upwards very, very quickly. And it's going up so quickly that there are more than three times as many people alive today than there were when I was born. And, you know, I have got grey hair, but I'm not all that old. It's predicted probably that the population is going to double from what it is now. That it might stabilise at 11 or 12 billion people. And there's lots of amazing statistics that follow from this rate of increase. For instance, half the people alive today are under 21. For instance, there are more people alive today than have ever lived in the entire history since 10,000 years ago. So if you're a Christian, that certainly gives impetus to that phrase of Jesus that's saying the harvest fields are ready for harvest. The number of people is growing immensely, and so the load on this planet is growing immensely. And it looks as if it will be impossible to carry on as we have been doing hitherto. And that's a tricky one to respond to. I just put it there for your consideration, really. If we carry on just as we are now, burning fossil fuels, then the amount of fossil fuel over the next century is going to increase hugely. If we really try hard, I don't really want it to do that. If we really try hard, then we might get this a slow reduction in use, we might get the green curve. If we really, really try hard, we might get our consumption to drop by looking for alternative energy sources and so on. But because the Earth is so sluggish in responding, the next one shows the same colours, what happens to temperature. If we just have business as usual, the temperature is going to go up something like 5 degrees probably this century. There is uncertainty, this is the uncertainty limit, but that's the best guess. If we reduce the rate of increase of fossil fuel use, it's still going to go up over 2 degrees. If we try really, really hard, it's still going to go up pretty well 2 degrees. And this is the issue that's so important, that we've already done a lot to this Earth. So the temperature increase that we've already put in will take about 2 or 3 centuries to feed through into the oceans, and the oceans will just expand and warm up. So sea level rise is going to continue for centuries to come just from what we've done already. The temperature is going to carry on increasing for decades to come, even if we stop producing carbon dioxide instantly today. And the issue of morality, I guess, is that the people that are causing this problem is a small part of the world's population. It's basically the heavily industrialized nations, North America, Europe, Australia, those sort of places, are producing more than half the pollution. The lowest sixth of the world's population, most of whom are living on a dollar a day, produce a tiny amount of it. But the people who will suffer will be these people on the right-hand side. Because if you live in Bangladesh, which is something like 20 million people live within a metre of sea level. If sea level rises, Bangladesh is a delta, you can't do anything about it. You'll lose your livelihood, you'll have to move. Whereas if sea level rises half a metre here, we'll just build the Thames Barrier a bit higher, I presume, and we can afford to do it. The other thing that I want to really point to is that as climate changes, there's more energy in the atmosphere, and one of the main problems is not so much the temperature increase. You know, we might quite like to be able to go to the Costa del Brighton for our holidays at Easter, but it is that there will be more extreme events. The weather events probably are going to get more extreme. So droughts will last longer, and if a drought in sub-Saharan Africa lasts for 2 years and you're a subsistence farmer, you'll starve unless somebody gives you some food. And equally, there will be places where there'll be a lot more flooding as well, because the water will come out in more extreme ways. And we've seen that in the past couple of weeks, indeed. That's Katrina, which was a wake-up call to America. It may not have been caused by global warming, but it was a wake-up call, certainly. So extreme events will become more common. This is a prediction of temperature in Northern Europe, and we've already seen it. And I said we should worry about those poor places like sub-Saharan Africa, but actually, even in Europe, in summer of 2003, there was a heat wave, and in France, mostly in Paris, 20,000 people died that July above the normal death rate, 20,000 extra. A similar thing has happened in Chicago. And that's because it was just a couple of degrees C hotter than the norm. And of course, the people that died were the vulnerable again. They were the old people that couldn't cope, and some very young people, mostly old people. Well, in another couple of decades, that will be the norm. So these extreme events are important. Now, it's really hard to estimate how many deaths are caused by global warming at the moment. But this was one estimate, which was published in Nature, which is the preeminent scientific journal, so it's pretty robust. You die perhaps from drought or from increased susceptibility to disease, like malaria or something like that. And if it's combined with being malnourished as well, then if you're already living on the edge, a bit of climate change might push you over. And you can see that. You can see the red colours are where most people are vulnerable to dying. And it's not us, again, in the north here that are causing the problem. It's the people in sub-Saharan Africa and South America and Asia who are suffering and who are likely to die. Well, one of the little-known things, I think, is that floods are actually one of the world's biggest killers. It's not earthquakes. It's not volcanoes. I work on both those. It's actually as mundane as floods. And I guess perhaps we have some understanding of that just from this the floods in the West Country this earlier this summer, where amazingly 6 people died in Britain from flooding. And I don't know if you know this, it doesn't really penetrate through to our Western world a bit, but on the 13th of November 1970, more than 500,000 people died in Bangladesh from flooding. It's a shocking statistic. And that is not uncommon. If you look back through the last century and a half, for instance, there's been floods in China where between 1 and 2 million people died in 1887 when the Yellow River flooded. Again, in 1931 it flooded. Between 1 and possibly 4 million people died during that. And it's estimated that during the 20th century, floods like those affected something like 100 million people. And probably by 2025, which isn't actually all that far away, less than 20 years away, half the world's population will be at risk from storms. Well, the reason is, of course, that people live near water. You live in a river valley to get water, or you live near the coast for communications. So these are, you know, serious things, and climate change is going to affect storms and make them worse and more severe. So we'll expect to see more of that. We'll expect to see more and more environmental refugees, estimated that up to 200 million environmental refugees. That's as opposed to refugees from war or fighting due to climate change. This happens to be the Maldives. If you live there, of course, and it's an average of a metre above sea level, then a metre sea level rise destroys your home. It is no longer. So certainly refugees are going to be a big issue. Well, that's the scientific background, and I'd be happy to answer more about that, but that's just sort of a thumbnail sketch. I think there are really interesting theological responses to this, partly because, as I say, it's those of us that live in the high-income countries that have caused the problem, whereas those that suffer will be those that live in low-income countries. So Before I do that, I want to look at just some of the theological issues. I want to start by looking at the first chapter of the Bible, Genesis 1, which, if you like, is God's mission statement. I know that many companies have mission statements to set out what their aims are. And I think Genesis 1 is God's mission statement because it sets the foundation for everything that follows on from it. So I want to just highlight three things that God says in this chapter about his purposes and our place in the cosmos. Because if we really believe there's a creator God, then of course we can't know his purposes unless he tells us. And partly he tells us through Genesis, through the Bible. So I want to just highlight three simple things, really. And the first is a really simple thing. It's that God created the universe. You might think that's silly for a Christian to be saying that. But it is in distinct contradiction, if you like, or contradistinction to many of the myths around at the time the Bible was written. You know, that the world was just the fallout from the gods fighting, and the people were created to be their slaves and their servants and so on. And I think, actually, it's markedly different from much modern thinking, that the earth is just an accident. You know, we happen to be in this universe, it's just accidental. And there it is, we can't say any more about it. It's meaningless and purposeless. Well, the Bible says something quite different. He says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He did it on purpose. He chose to do it. That's the first chapter of the first book of the Old Testament. And if you look at one of the first chapters of the New Testament in John's Gospel, verse 3, you'll say, through him, and that's talking about Jesus, through Jesus, all things were made. And then, just in case you didn't get the message, John says the same thing the other way around. He says, in fact, without him, nothing was made that has been made. So the clear message is that God made the world of his own free will, of his choice, because he chose to. It's a purposeful place. So that's an important thing to hold in our minds. The second thing is that God's material creation is good. This is just a cuneiform tablet from the 7th century BC, which has got some of the myths of how the world was created. I think this is the Gilgamesh myth. The myths around at the time were quite different from what the Bible's saying, that the Bible was created, that the earth was created purposefully. Second point, then, is that God's material creation is good. And that actually comes through time and time again in Genesis. So if you look at verse 3, God separated the light from the darkness. He saw that it was good, he says in verse 4. Next thing he did, he made this dry land, and God saw that it was good, it says in verse 10. Verse 12, he made the vegetation, the plants and the trees, and God saw that it was good. And then he made the sun, moon and stars. God saw that it was good. It sort of gets boring, really, doesn't it? Verse 21, the next day he made the sea creatures and the birds. God saw it was good. Made the animals. God saw that it was good. And then after he'd done all this really hard week's work, he sat back, verse 25, he'd made humans, he looked back at everything he'd said, he'd made, and he said it was very good. Well, I think you can't fail to get that message that Genesis 1 is trying to tell us. It's trying to tell us that God made the world, and he made a world which is good. His material creation is good. So it's saying matter matters to God. So I would want to say that Christianity is a very materialist religion. It's rooted in a material world. God came to earth, it claims, as a specific person, Jesus, at a specific time in the first century, in a specific place in the Middle East when it was under Roman rule. It's very rooted in material things. And actually, that sets aside Christianity from most of the other religions in the world. So there's no place here for the sort of religion that says we should strive for some higher spiritual plane because the material things of this world are bad and to be striven against. Christianity has its feet very firmly on the ground, which I'm glad about because I'm a geologist. So God says unambiguously that he made the world and that it was a good world. So the world, God gloried in his creation, and the creation in turn reflects something of God's glory. The psalmist David, sitting on his hill, said, "The heavens declare the glory of God." You can imagine him sitting up there watching his sheep in the dark night, seeing these amazing stars. Well, I want to show you, I'll run it in just a minute. I want to show you something which is very striking, I think. This is a transcript of a broadcast from Apollo 8, which was made on Christmas Eve 1968. Now, Apollo 8, for those of you that are space aficionados, it was piloted by Lovell, Anders, and Borman, and it was the first of the Apollo missions that actually went round the moon. So they put themselves into moon orbit, went round, I forget, a dozen times, and then came out of orbit again. And I think it was on their ninth orbit. If you listen to the transcript, it's full of passing details of gauge pressures and oxygen amount left and fuel levels and so on and temperatures in the pod. But partway through it, they said to Houston Control, "Can we? We've got a message we'd like to read. Can we do that?" And Houston says, "Go ahead." And they do it. And what they chose to read was those opening verses from Genesis chapter 1. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And in fact, all three of them read in turn. So all three of them did this on Christmas Eve, 1968. Now I'm going to play it. You'll have to listen quite hard because it is 1968 technology. They were 250,000 miles away from Earth. It was analog. But I think it's actually a very striking moment, which I think people forget about the space mission. I mean, it is it's the anniversary at the moment, isn't it? The 50th anniversary of the first space launch. And just listen to this.
Is that human beings could share in the event as it was happening. We felt the awe and the wonder that these three men were experiencing so far from their home planet. Look at the step we were taking. And in that moment, they were touching base with the most fundamental narrative we have, the creation story.
I think that's an incredibly moving piece, actually. These guys were orbiting the moon. They had to do a manual firing of their rockets around the back of the moon. And it was all done on manual orientation of spacecraft. And they didn't really know whether it would work. There was a chance they'd get stuck there or they'd fly off into space. And they seriously thought the chance was only one in a few. And these guys were up there. And this photo they took is apparently the most reproduced image in the world ever of the Earth from the Moon. And there's an interesting postscript to this. There was a Japanese reporter covering this launch, And she phoned up the media correspondent at Houston and said, "Oh, that was a wonderful piece they read there. Can you give me a transcript of it?" And he was on the ball. He said, "Are you staying in a hotel?" "Actually, yeah, I'm in a hotel in downtown Houston." He said, "Well, if you just go to your bedside table and open the door and look on page one, you'll find it." So God made a world. He made a good world. And the third thing I want to say, just in the background theology, is that he upholds it continually. He sustains it. Now, the picture here is that God is upholding it, and if he chose to let go, it would descend into chaos. For instance, in the New Testament, it says Jesus is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. Or again, in Colossians, the Apostle Paul says, "For by Jesus all things were created, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together." Now, the sort of picture this is of, say, a television. If you're watching a show on television, a play or something, you can really engage with it. You can cheer for the heroes, you know, and boo the villains and so on. But that picture is only sustained by continual flow of electrons. And if that stops, it just descends into those little black and white dots all over your screen, into chaos. So the picture the Bible is giving is of God upholding his creation moment by moment in the way that he chooses. And I'm a scientist, and I take it as part of God's goodness to us, his grace to us, that he's made it a world we can understand, you know, can make sense of, and we can work out how to get inoculations against smallpox so that millions of people don't die of smallpox. Smallpox has essentially been eradicated from this world, and leprosy almost so, and things like that. I think that's part of God's goodness. So it's a creation which is understandable and which we can interact with, and God is sustaining it continually. So those are the three theological points. So it's not at all like this cartoon which came from the Herald Sun, the big break theory for how God created the universe. It's as if that theory is that God set it all going and then disappeared off the scene and left it to itself. The Christian picture is of God upholding it moment by moment. Well, how about a Christian response then for the last little bit of this talk? I just want to talk about basically four ways that we should respond. And the first thing is that if God cares for his creation this much, then so should we. So if we neglect and abuse and despoil a world, we're not only damaging something that's precious to God, but we're also preventing the created order from reflecting God's glory fully. Christopher Patton put it this way in his lectures in 2000. It's living here as though we were intending to stay for good and not just for the weekend. And so if we don't care for the world in which we live, we're acting rather like the teenagers who, with a wild party, have wrecked a family home, if you like, that has been lovingly created for them by parents. Something that happened at Easter, I noticed, this last year. And there's lots of little bits in Scripture that talks about God's care. So in Psalms, it talks about the lions roar for their prey and they seek their food from God. Or in Psalm 147, God covers the sky with clouds. He supplies the earth with rain. He makes grass grow on the hills. He provides food for the cattle and for the young ravens when they call. You know, this is a sense of God caring for his creation. And indeed, these are things without humans there, it's talking about, as well as humans. Another one in Psalm 65, the grasslands of the desert overflows, the meadows are covered with flocks, and the valleys are mantled with grains. They shout for joy and sing. It's as if the creation God made is responding to their creator in that great way. So God cares for his creation, so we should. Now, the second thing is, for Christians, that we should care for this world because God gave us a straight command to do so. It's actually the first command he ever gave humankind in Genesis 1 verse 27. He said that humans are made in his own image, in the image of God he created them, and he told us to care for the world. Well, I'll come to that bit in a minute. I just want to talk a little bit about what it means to be made in the image of God. What I take this to mean is that we're not just animals, although of course we are animals as well. We share 95% of our DNA with chimps, and you can trace our DNA connections with all other living organisms. But we're something special. We're made in his image. Now, some of those things which make us different from God is, I presume, if we're made in God's image, it means we can relate to God, that he made us to be relational people with other people, but with himself in particular. So we can love and be loved. We have a sense of right and wrong. We can take responsibility for our actions. We can be creative like God was. The psalmist talks about God throwing stars into space, all million, 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 millions, 10 to the 24 of them. He just made them because he wanted to. And actually, one of the things that I think really distinguishes humans from animals is that we're moral beings, so we have a sense of justice. And what I mean by that is if you watch the news, say you watch a court case that maybe some child has been murdered, and they finally got the murderer in court a couple of years later, and he's been found guilty and sentenced. And then they almost always, you watch this on the TV next time there is one, they almost always interview the parents on the steps of the court afterwards. And almost always the parents say, "We just wanted to see justice." Now, finding that person guilty is not going to make any objective change to their circumstances. You know, they lost their child, was murdered, or whatever. But they just wanted to see justice. And I think that deep sense, that deep requirement for justice is something that marks us out as humans. And I take it that if we're made in God's image, that's just a pale reflection of God's concern for justice. And I think that if we got to the gates of heaven, you know, and there were unrepentant murderers and child molesters there, and God said to them, "Oh, that's all right, that doesn't matter, let's ignore that, shall we?" I think we'd be outraged. And God is outraged by rebellion against him. So sense of justice is part of it. Now, humans are animals as well, as I said. We share the same food as other animals. It talks about that in Genesis 1, in fact. Same breath of life is given to humans and animals alike. And in fact, Genesis 2 uses the same word to describe how animals, birds and humans were formed from the ground. In fact, he says humans were formed from the dust of the ground. So that's hardly an accolade of superiority compared to the animals. So we are animals as well, but we're made in the image of God as well. And this is that command that he gave, the very first command. He said, "Be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Now, perhaps a more modern version of saying that is to say we're asked to be stewards of the earth. We're not to be passive spectators. We're to work at ruling and ordering creation as in the way that God would. And it's part of our obedience to God to do that. So we're to bring order where there's disorder and so on. So it's perhaps rather like a garden. If you've got a garden, you know, if you just ignore it, it gets covered with weeds. If you rule it properly, you know, it's fruitful and you get fruit and you get beautiful flowers and so on. So human flourishing and the well-being of creation are inextricably linked in the biblical narrative. And the view that the Bible seems to give is that we're to steward the earth in the way that God would steward it if he were here. We're supposed to be co-regents on his behalf. Now, in the centuries BC, the rulers of Babylon and so on used to put up images of themselves around their borders. And they did that to say, "This is what I'm like, I rule here, I own this land." And in a way, I think the fact that we're made in the image of God is that we're set on earth to be co-regents with him, if you like, to rule it in the way he would have ruled it. So it's as if we should be helping the earth to be fruitful and to play its intended part in God's creation. And actually, if you just notice, it's not only a command, but there's a privilege there because God blesses humanity in doing it. And perhaps the most helpful picture here of this ruling is of the shepherd or the servant king ruling creation, not for the sake of themselves, but for the sake of others. And that's the role that Jesus explicitly took on himself when he came to earth. He likened himself to a servant king ruling for that. So it's directed entirely to the benefit of God's kingdom and glory and not our own. So God's creation is good. We're commanded to be stewards of it on his behalf. And then the third point is that we should care for the earth because that's a way of showing our care for our neighbours, actually. If we do things that hurt them, then we're certainly not caring for them. Interestingly, you might have noticed, I'm sure you saw Richard Charters a while ago. He captured headlines by saying, he's the Bishop of London here, by saying, "Making selfish choices such as flying on holiday or buying a large car are a symptom of sin." Now, I think that really phased the headline writers. Had no idea what he was talking about. Why was that a symptom of sin? But I think what he was getting at was if what we do hurts other people for the worse, then that is a symptom of sin if we ignore what we're doing. So that's the point I was making earlier. That it's the effect of what we're doing if it impacts others and we keep doing it knowingly, then that's a symptom of sin. And I think those of us in high-income nations with a standard of living that's been purchased through profligate use of natural resources, we have a particular responsibility in our stewardship, I think, an imperative to care for others elsewhere who are affected and marginalised by global climate change. So that's a responsibility that goes to people we may not be able to see on the other side of the world. It may go to the next generation that we can't see at the moment either, because what we're doing now will affect them. So it seems to me that we should use the underlying goodness and fruitfulness of the creation to do what is pleasing to God in this time and place, which I want to turn to next. But just as a couple of last things I want to say before we finish is that if I keep telling you that this is a wonderful, good world that God made, I guess you might wonder whether I'm living on a different planet, actually, because after all, you know, the 20th century was the most murderous century in human life. More people were murdered in that century than ever before in the whole of history by their fellow humans. And it's as if it's a world that's sort of out of kilter somehow, that it's marred. And the Bible says, yes, it is, and it's marred because people created by God have chosen not to obey him. They've turned their back on him, and they've rebelled against him, is what the Bible says. So if I just give a brief history of Christianity, if you like, it's that creation has been created by God to be very good, but we've spoilt it. And we've not only spoilt our own relationship with God, we've spoilt somehow the way that creation's working as well. We've marred that. But the Christian hope is that that isn't the end of the line. You see, it's as if we've said, "My will be done, not thine," to God the Creator. Now, if we are really his creatures and we've said that, that sort of rebellion, that sort of thumbing our nose at him, of turning our backs on him, saying, "Oh, I don't care," is rebellion. And there are consequences for rebellion, which are fatal. Death is a consequence. But the Christian message is one of hope. And I want to say at the end that the Christian message is definitely one of hope with respect to climate change as well. But it's one of hope with respect to our relationship with God. Because the message is that we're not necessarily have to remain permanently alienated from God. Because Jesus came to carry that penalty for our rebellion. And the Christian message is that if we turn around and say we're sorry, the technical term is repent, which means repent means to turn around, then God's longing to forgive us and restore that relationship with him. But of course, if we don't want that relationship with him, if we just want to say, no, I don't want to have anything to do with you, then he doesn't treat us like puppets, like machines. He gives us that freedom to do that. And if we refuse to have a relationship with him, then of course there isn't a two-way relationship. So the Christian hope is that there is a way forward out of hopelessness. And I think there's also a strong Christian hope in the last pages and the last part of the Bible, which is that this creation will be renewed in due course. Now, I think most of what I've said about caring for creation now would be shared by, you know, right-thinking people of liberal who just want to do good for other people. They'd say, yeah, of course we should modify our behaviour so other people aren't damaged by it. Of course, that's obvious. We should do good to others. But this last point, I think, is a distinctively Christian point, that there is a long-term future for this world. There is a new creation, which gives Christian hope for the future of the world as well as us individually. Now, the Christian view is that there will be a new heavens and a new earth, where there will be no more crying and no more tears and no more pain, for the old order of things has passed away. And the Christian view is that God will come down and live with his people. Now, it won't be exactly the same sort of place here as it is now. There'll be continuity but discontinuity. And I just want to say a couple of words about that before we stop. In fact, Paul faced this because somebody asked the Apostle Paul, if people are going to be raised from the dead, they're going to have eternal life in heaven, what kind of body will they come with? And Paul said, that's a stupid question. Well, he was more polite than that. He said, how foolish. But he said, basically, that's a really stupid question. And he went on to explain it. He said, when you sow, you don't plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. So as little seeds of wheat grow into corn, or if you like, little tiny acorns grow into oak trees. Now there's discontinuity there because they're quite different sort of forms. There's continuity as well because it's grown from the other. And I think Paul's trying to say with our bodies, there's some of that continuity and discontinuity between this world and the world to come if we're Christians. Now, Luther, interestingly, said, if I knew Jesus would return tomorrow, I'd plant a tree today. And I think what he's getting at is, if there is a long-term future for a new creation, which is the same sort of place where we'll know one another We'll love and be loved. We're not going to be spirits floating around on clouds playing harps. We're going to be real embodied people, because you can't have people without bodies nowadays. You won't be able to then either. If it's going to be like that, Luther was saying, then we might as well start practicing now what we're going to do in the long term, in all eternity, in fact. So the decisions we make in this world, the things we do and say, our personalities, they'll all in some sense carry on. Revelations 21 talks about the glory and honour of the nations being brought into heaven. So some of them will carry on. So there is this sense of discontinuity as well as continuity. But as far as the environment's concerned, what we're doing now ought to be a preview of what we'll do for all eternity if we're Christians. Interestingly, Lord Rees, who's president of the Royal Society, certainly not a Christian particularly, but he said this in his address, which he gives annually just in November last. He said, even in a cosmic or a geological times perspective, there's something unique about our century. For the first time in its history, our entire planet's fate depends on human actions and human choices. So as I finish, I want to say two things, really. First, the distinctively Christian attitude is underpinned by hope. It's worth working in God's creation now, not just because we're commanded to do so, but because it has got a future. And what we do now, in some sense, matters for that future. And the second thing is that Jesus said he came to make all things new. Now, we should have faith, therefore, not that all things can be different, but that all things will be different. Jesus didn't say, I'm coming to make all new things. He said, I come to make all things new. I'll recreate them in the way I intended it to be before it was spoiled by human rebellion. So that's a very holistic view, I think, that we should care not only for the spiritual needs of people, but for the material world as well, because God cares for that. And C.S. Lewis put this in a nutshell, as he often did with things. He said, the Christians who did most for the present world were precisely those who thought most of the next. Aim at heaven and you get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you get neither. So it seems to me that we should care for the stranger and the foreigner, even if they live on the other side of the world, because there is a Christian hope for the future. And as Jesus said, from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. So we're going to have a 5-minute break now, and drinks will be brought to you where you're seated. Please do take the opportunity to write down any questions you've got on the slip of paper, and then I'll walk up and down the aisle and pick them up in the next 5 minutes, and then Professor White will seek to answer them in our remaining time.
Actually, there's perhaps a couple of things I can say. I purposefully haven't talked at all about practical things, because Christianity is not a legalistic religion. But there are practical things we can do, and there's a really good book Tear Funder put out called For Tomorrow Too, which has some ideas about practical stuff. There's a pile at the back, they're free, you can pick those up. So do take those away if you just want to think, what can I do practically about this? And then, as you heard earlier, this book has just come out, Christianity, just last month, Climate Change and Sustainable Living. And there's some copies of that at the back as well. So, thanks.